Well, the topic today is the infinite Christ. So I wanted to share with you on that thought of infinity and the word infinite. It's used a lot on our path, and Master used a lot, and it's a lot in the Festival of Light. And the first story I was going to tell is from Swami's life. It was the 1960s, and he was in India. And someone told him about a book of ancient prophecy. It's called the Book of Bhrigu. And it's reputed to be anywhere from hundreds of years to perhaps thousands of years old. And he investigated a little bit, and this man told him that he could bring Swami to the book. It's not a book in the normal sense. It actually occupies entire rooms. It's volumes and volumes of predictions and prophecies. So Swami goes with this man, I think it was up to Rishikesh, goes into this room, and at the moment you ask, the moment you walk into the room, determines what page that this Pujari goes and finds. It has to do probably with astrology or something. I'm not really sure how it works. So Swami says, I'd like to have a reading. So the Pujari goes into the back room, comes out with a page, and he starts reading to Swami about the prophecies that involve Swami. And it tells him about a sibling that he had that Swami wasn't aware of. But later he went back and he asked his mom, and she said, well, actually, you did have a brother, but it was a stillbirth, so I never even talked to you about it. And it had details about Swami's life that he said no one could possibly know, let alone this man in a remote hill in India. And one of the most amazing facts is during the reading, and in the reading itself, the Pujari says, oh, there will be a thunderclap during this reading. And just then Swami says, the sky was blue when he walked into the room, there's this thunderclap. Now how, with a rational mind, can you figure out that someone could make that prediction hundreds, 50, thousands of years before the event, when Swami would arrive, when he would ask the question, that it would tie down to the minutest detail of there would be thunder that day? Someone sent out an email this week, Bill Yabroff, and it was of photos that the NASA has circulated. They were the best photos that they've taken all year from the Hubble spacecraft. And the winning photo is of a galaxy. It's 128 million light years from Earth. Now a light year is, light travels at 186,000 miles per second. And this galaxy is 128 million light years from Earth. Within this galaxy, there are 800 billion suns, and the distance across this galaxy is 50,000 light years. Now, modern science tells us that there are hundreds of billions of galaxies. So this is space that we know now in modern times. So when we start talking about infinite and infinity, we have to include this whole expanded view of our world. My son was interested in astronomy when he was young, and when we used to talk like this, he once asked me, he said, Dad, please stop. It makes my brain hurt. I went around the school this week as preparation for this talk and asked some of the middle schoolers. I said, so what's at the edge of creation? And one of the middle schoolers said, well, there's not really an edge. It just goes in a giant loop. And before I could say anything, they said, but that doesn't really explain what's outside the loop. And I asked one of the first graders, this little girl, Shuba. She's in a small body, but she's got a ton of energy. So I said, Shuba, what's at the edge of creation? And just blurted out, God! I said, what? She goes, God! But then she went away and she went into Barbara's classroom. And she said, Barbara, what's at the edge of creation? And Barbara, in her wisdom, said, who's asking the question? Oh, Gary. Oh, yeah, Gary, okay. She said, well, go say that sometimes it's good to sit with the big questions and to recognize the fact that there are some mysteries out there. There are some things we maybe don't understand. I thought that was a good answer. Somebody asked Yogananda once, what's at the edge of creation? He said, God alone exists at the edge of creation. I think these are kind of, we're trying to figure out something that's infinite with a finite brain. One time I was sitting on a hill up at Point Reyes, and I started to think about my parents. They were showing the first signs of aging a little bit. And I started to think, gosh, what's it going to be like when my parents pass away? And, which one's going to pass away first? What's my mom going to go? Is my dad? How's the other one going to cope? They'd been married for so many years. And then I started to think, well, gosh, about that same time, all my aunts and uncles are going to be dying. And then I started to think about, well, someday my brothers are going to die. I'm going to die. I was looking out at a forest, and I thought, all these trees are going to die. Every single person, all the world leaders, we're all going to pass. We're going to leave this earth. This earth itself, I was thinking, is someday going to lose its orbit and just crash and burn into the sun. And I started to think on a kind of that profound level, and it wasn't morbid, but it really shook me up a little bit. It shook me up so much I forgot my point. But I'll get it back. In the Buddha play that we have coming up this year, we're going to do Buddha again. There's a passage from Buddha's life. And the discussion Friday at the casting play is, well, did this really happen or is this some mythical story? But Buddha was a young child. He was born, and a psychic, an astrologer, somebody did a reading for him. And he told the father, who was a great king, he said, this boy could either be a great world leader and a wonderful king and a dominant king, but he also has this tendency to be renunciate. So he has these two things going, and he may renounce the whole world. So the story goes that the father who wanted his son to be the king shielded him from everything outside of him in the way of suffering. That if a flower started to droop just a little bit, they were told to cut it. No one sick was ever allowed to be near the Buddha. He never saw anyone grow old. He never saw death. But he was curious one day, and he took his friend Chana outside the palace grounds, and the first person he saw had a little gray hair and some wrinkles. And the Buddha said, actually at this time he's Prince Siddhartha, he says, so what's going on here? Why does this person have gray hair and wrinkles? And Chana says, well, that's what happens when you get old. He goes, well, is this the only person who's turned old? And Chana says, well, no, he's not the only person. In fact, most people get to grow old. The Buddha goes, there's something not right about this. Take me back to the palace. So they take Buddha back. The second time he goes out, he sees someone with disease. He says, Chana, what's going on? Chana says, well, disease strikes. You never know when. It could strike a child. It could strike a woman. It could strike a man, young or old. You just never know when it could happen to you. It could happen to anyone. Buddha said it could happen to my father, the king. Well, yeah, no one's exempt from that. He goes, this doesn't make any sense. I don't like this. This is crazy. He goes back to the palace. Third time he comes out with Chana, he sees a funeral procession. He says, Chana, what's this? What's happened to this person? Well, he's died. Well, does this happen to, is this the way it is for everyone? He goes, yeah. If you escape disease, maybe you won't get old, but everyone has to die sometime. Buddha just says, this is ridiculous, and he goes back. It's one of the most poignant scenes in this whole play, and it's done by children, but the truth of it is so powerful because we all live this life with this reality, but we don't really cope with it. I had a crazy story happen to me. I was, this is way back when I was really just trying to get on the path. It was really difficult for me to establish meditation in my life. I wanted to do it. I liked the teachings, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And I was living up the Russian River at the time, and I kind of hit one of my rock bottoms, and I hitchhiked up to Ananda to visit my brother Ananta. And he lived in a teepee at the time on the side of a hill. And I slept underneath his deck in a sleeping bag. And the first night, this huge thunder and lightning storm came in. And I was just nice and comfortable and dry underneath the deck. And I spent the whole week just living at Ananda, meeting people, cutting firewood with the nuns, just having a great, great time. And it started to establish in me, because everyone around me was meditating, the hope that maybe I could live in a community or maybe just start meditation. And Ananta was telling me how important it is to live with other people who meditate too when you're trying to establish the habit. but I'm leaving Ananda and I'm living out at the Rushing River. He said, well, it just so happens that Ananda has this community out there. It's called Ocean Song. It's just beginning. And it's not really set up for new people, but maybe you could ask Vidura and Durga, who are running it, if you could stay there. So I did. I went back home. I went up to Ocean Song. I asked them, can I just stay and help out? I worked on the farm. Sita was there. But I had one foot on the spiritual path and one foot in my cabin at the Russian River and this lifestyle. I used to love to party. I really enjoyed partying. Very much. I was the life of the party. But it was taking its toll. So I'm at Ocean Song. So one night, they start telling me the monks are coming. The monks are going to come up and they're going to spend a weekend with us. It's going to be really great. I remember the number 40, which seems impractical, but that's what I thought. 40, they're going to come on a bus. We're going to do kirtans. We're going to have all this great time. And I was thinking, oh, God, you know, I just wanted to meditate and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I literally drove out my car outside of Ocean Song, parked it on the road, and I'm literally leaning on a fence watching the sunset, trying to figure out, should I go back to the Russian River and party all weekend, or should I stay and meditate with the monks? You know, dear God, please give me a sign. So this car comes barreling up about 50 miles an hour, slams on his brakes. The guy jumps out of the car, and he starts accosting me. You don't know who you've been messing with. I'm going to teach you a lesson you're never going to forget. You just don't know what you've been doing. And I have no idea what he's talking about. And I'm just standing there, and he goes on. And I think he's either crazy, or I think maybe he's on drugs, amphetamines or something, because he's absolutely livid, and he's shaking. He reaches in his car, he pulls out a rifle, a Winchester, pulls it out. You don't know you've been, oh, we're going to teach you a lesson. He cocks the rifle. Because he can see I'm not scared because I have absolutely no frame of reference for this event. I'm just standing there kind of like, he cocks the rifle to try and scare me. And we just have this standoff. We're both just standing there and I don't know what to do. And he doesn't, I don't think, know what to do. The second car comes barreling up, slams on his brake. Guy jumps out and he's looking at me and he's looking at my car. He's looking at me. He says, hey, Bill, this ain't the same guy. The other guy was driving a Toyota. This is a Volvo. So then he, in true 70s style, he puts a gun down and he reaches out. And he says, hey, man, it's cool. It's cool. I go, yeah, I guess so. Now, I usually stop the story here. They drive off. It turns out that they were growing marijuana and someone had come to try and steal their crop. And I matched the description. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I found all that out later. And usually I stop the story there. But what I had forgotten, and I remembered just recently when I was preparing for a Sunday service, I decided to go and spend the weekend with the monks and meditate with them. I'd asked for a sign, and I guess this fell into the general category of a sign. I couldn't meditate for 10 minutes in those days. I had the most restless mind imaginable. So we were in this old the deer hunters used to use this, and they hadn't even fixed things up yet at Ocean Song. It was all smoky walls, and it was just really funky. But all these monks come, and we all pile into the temple, I guess it was. And we start doing a kirtan, and they start saying, okay, we're going to meditate for half an hour. And I was just like completely freaked out about meditating half an hour. But this is an interesting moment. Master says you shouldn't talk about phenomena that happens to you, but you'll see by the story that it never actually happened to me. I'm leaning there meditating, and I'm brand new, and I start to have this incredible out-of-the-body experience. My consciousness, you know, the vocabulary just doesn't cover it. My consciousness just starts to go up the spine and just expand outward. I mean, huge. And I kind of freak out, and I'm just not expecting it, and I'm not used to it, and I have no vocabulary. So I, like, pull it back in. And then I start meditating again, and it starts happening again. And I just had no wherewithal to deal with it. So I just kind of like pulled it back in and opened my eyes, and I'm like, oh, you know, does this happen to everyone who sits to meditate? That's late 1979. I haven't had that experience since then. I've had some wonderful experiences. I've got to go to India on pilgrimage. I've got to meditate with all of you in the 8-hour meditations. I've never had that experience again. When we start talking about infinite consciousness, and we start talking about, you know, our minds would go to that nearest galaxy and beyond. And that's just creation. Master would talk about the astral world and the causal world. So when we sit to meditate, we should think big. We should really start to think, you know, like this whole universe is us, and that we don't have to think about our little problems and our little issues and our little limitations. We should just try to just expand outward, because that is us. That's what Master said. That's his teachings, and that's our destiny.
That person at Ocean Song, Bill, he mentioned, that was Ocean's, that was our neighbor. He lived down the hill from us at Ocean Song, and he was threatening to kill Gary, but at the same time saying that, it's cool, man, it's all right. I'm not going to shoot you. We had 4 or 5 or 6 years out at Ocean Song together, and we were really tested with many opportunities to grow, and also opportunities to work with some interesting neighbors next to us. Gary and I used to give service quite often together. This is our first time in many years. When I had returned from the Ananda Center in Dallas, our first sermons were at family services. We used to give sermons to the children. And the very first one we did together, I mean, you're incredibly nervous, even though your crowd is only 4 foot high with their parents, but still, we were very nervous. That I can remember during Gary's sermon to the children, his pin popped and went flying, and his just disrobed. The chudder just fell off. And I remember that I was the one that pinned him. And it was definitely the highlight for the children. That everything we said, that was a thing they remembered. Interesting enough, I pinned Tushti today, and he didn't see it because it happened outside, but pop, off it came. His fingers are great for tickling Tagini, but they're not very good for pinning. I was in Assisi, Italy many years ago for the first time, and I had a connection growing up with St. Francis of Assisi. In the little city I grew up in, there were two Catholic churches, and St. Francis of Assisi was one of them, and that's where my mother brought the family for Sunday service. And what I remember of the church there in Tonawanda, New York, was the big stone carving of Francis up on the front of the church building. That I found very interesting. What happened inside the building, I didn't find very interesting. My mind could not kind of latch onto what the priest was saying during service. And my mind was like an open space. It can really roam when I don't have any kind of something to latch onto. So during those 18 years I was going to this church, I just had a wonderful intuitive feeling about Francis. And even the very first car that I had growing up, on the visor was pinned on the back of the visor, St. Francis of Assisi medallion. So as I got older, and I forgot all about that connection with Francis, it was through reading Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, that I was reintroduced to Jesus and also to Francis. So there I was so many years ago, arriving in Assisi, and I had just come from India after a pilgrimage with the Ananda group, and many of us got off our plane in Germany and went down to the Ananda Center in Assisi. The very first church I walked into, because it was my first time, if you've never been to Assisi, you need to go, because it's the heart of Italy. And it's so full of divine light that it's not yogi, it's not yogic, it's not Catholic, it's not Christian. It is a divine, infinite presence you feel there, that has no boundaries to it. As Gary was saying, it is limitless. And it is an absolute deep experience for who you are as a person. So the very first church I walked into was Santa Chiara. And this church hangs this large cross, the cross that spoke to Francis. And it was very dark. It was November. It was cold. And a few years ago, they had an earthquake, so everything's been refurbished. But in this particular dark, I remember being cold, coming from India, I sat down to meditate. Nobody was in this room. And I was there for quite a long time. And when I opened my eyes, I was actually shocked to see that I was sitting in a church in Italy. You know, I had just come from India, meditating in a lot of temples. I had that rhythm going of wherever I was, meditating. And what it helped me to realize in waking up and opening my eyes and seeing where I was is that the sensation that I had in meditating, that I was still in India, that I still could smell the smells of India, I could still hear the sounds of India, mixed in with the silence of this church in the West, in Italy, that a cross that spoke to St. Francis was hanging. I found that in that moment, that infinite Christ consciousness exists everywhere, without any form, without any denomination, without any way to be except yourself. Gary was talking about the vastness of the galaxy, an incredibly vast galaxy. But the unique thing about that and the beauty of it all is that there is only one of us. There's only one Raghu. There's only one Gary, one of each of you that exists in this vast galaxy. And that's the beauty. That's our connection with this creation, the manifestation of the divine. When I was in Dallas, in Texas, you know, it's a very strong religious center, state. And I can remember going to Home Depot to pick up supplies and coming up to the clerk with our check, our church check. And she looked at it. She said, "I never heard of your church." And I said, "Well, we're over there in Farmers Branch, it was called." And she said, "Well, do you believe in Jesus Christ?" And I said, "I do. I do. We do. I believe in Jesus. He's right there in the center of our altar." And she said, "Praise Jesus. Praise Jesus Christ." I said, "Praise Jesus Christ." So afterwards, leaving, I thought, it's kind of odd for a Home Depot clerk to be asking me about my what I believe. But at the same time, I thought, you can't put this infinite consciousness into a shoebox. It can't be just this way, the only way, or it's the highway. Swami, I was listening to a tape of his saying, it was a tape on yoga and Christianity. He was saying that he knew a lot of Indians, a lot of Hindus, who've had visions of Jesus. And each of those visions, these people, they weren't asked to become Christians by Jesus. I can remember going up to Sonoma Mountain Zen Center years ago while I was living at Ocean Song. It's probably a good thing Divine Mother didn't link Gary and I up at Ocean Song at that time. She waited until we were in Palo Alto together. It's actually probably pretty good that we were born on opposite ends of the country, me in the east and him in the west. But I remember going to Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, and the Roshi there, he said, "You want to stay for the weekend? We're going to have an extended meditation." And I said, "I'd be glad to, but I want you to know that I'm a yogi and I practice Kriya Yoga and I'm a disciple of Yogananda, Paramahansa Yogananda." And he said, "Oh, I've read his book." "And Autobiography of a Yogi?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, it's okay, you can practice your Kriya." He wasn't asking me to become Buddhist. He was asking me to continue my practice and to support those people who I was practicing with for that weekend. The infinite Christ consciousness is already inside of us. It's there. It exists. It doesn't have to be a form, but it has to be expressed. You know, I look at this altar. It's beautiful. I know the person who created the altar for this Sunday, the arrangements. But the beauty of it for me is seeing that consciousness of creativity, that spirit flowing through this person to create this. Now, maybe she did pray over the altar and say, "Help me get this thing right." But at the same time, it doesn't have to be that way. It can just flow through you if you allow it. to happen. The infinite Christ consciousness, the infinite Christ is already right there. And the more we're able to tap, just tap into that center, the more creativity flows, the more you are more of yourself. You don't, what becomes less of yourself is the attachment to the ego. But what becomes more is your connection with the spirit, and then it is not hard to connect with the spirit. You don't have to work at it. In the beginning, you do have to work at it. You have to reestablish it through meditation, through saying yes to life, through being joyful. But once you begin to tap into it, it's there. You feel it. You're surrounded by it. You see it in other people. You're connected with it. When Swami was in Dallas years ago, when he was down for a week, before he gave his Sunday service, we were in a brand new building, and I was helping him with his robe, and he came out, and he says, "I need to see the room." So he looks at the room, he goes, "Okay." He comes back in, I put the robe, help him with his robe, we sit down to meditate, and after meditation, I said, "You always do that when you come into a new room, don't you, a building, to give a talk, even if it's a lecture?" And he goes, "I do." And I said, "Is it because that you put your aura out in the room before you go out there?" And he says, "Yeah." And he says, "Everybody should do that. Everybody should do that." And he says, "Even if you're driving on a trip somewhere, you put your aura out into the trip. You surround your car. You pray to that infinite Christ inside of us. Christ consciousness right here. That's what we pray for. That's what we try to open up. If it exists already, which it does, if it is not kept in a shoebox, that it is expansive, that it is beyond what we can possibly logically understand, it doesn't matter. What does matter is that we're a part of it already. And being a part of it already means that every day, every moment, we can go through whatever routines that we do, whatever you do during the day, and still have that connection and that feel for it. It's not just about, do you believe in Jesus Christ the only way? It just can't be that way. It is much, much, much more than that. So drop the forms in yourself. Drop your identification of who you think you are and realize that who you really are, who we all really are, is this infinite Christ consciousness that exists already inside of us.